What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, yeah, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know.
And we welcome you in the Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagles are in studio, Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside. My name is Sam Panionovich. Plenty to talk about changing the Illinois Constitution. There's a federal probe into Fox News, possibility of a travel ban, and then, of course, the grab bag. But I believe, guys, we have a person who has leaped Bill Cosby in the topics on this show, and that's President Trump. He is overtaken. Yeah, it's the most popular topic pretty much every week, and we welcome to join the show to kick it off a return guest, Professor Alan Dershowitz, Harvard University, and the newest book, Taking the Stand, My Life and the Law. Welcome back, Professor.
Hey, it's always a pleasure to be on with you.
Thanks. One of our favorite guests here on the show. Professor, why do you think Trump did not obstruct justice when he fired Jim Comey earlier this week?
In order to obstruct justice, you have to do something illegal, and Trump didn't do anything illegal. He fired Comey, as he had a right to do. Even Comey acknowledges that, and I don't think we want to put people's minds on trial. We don't want to say, what was he really motivated by? What was really going on in his head? We'll never know that. Very likely what happened is he was watching TV. He saw Comey testify. Comey said he was nauseous because he might have affected the election. Trump got very upset, decided to fire him, then, you know, wrote to the attorney general and said, hey, get me a memo to justify firing him. You'd never be able to prove an obstruction of justice. And as a civil libertarian, I wouldn't want to see the obstruction of justice law stretched so far that it could get somebody for doing something legal. Today it would be used against Trump. Tomorrow it would be used against somebody that we have different feelings about.
Well, I think no one questions the president's authority to fire any of his employees. I think the question, and as you know, obviously, is whether he did so with the intent, and as you referenced, you have to have the requisite intent to commit a criminal act, whether he did so with the intent of obstructing justice. And in your opinion, he didn't, because he didn't have the actus reus and the mens rea,
well,
right? Both which are,
well,
of which are necessary.
It doesn't matter what his intent was or what his motive was. Now, there are cases that say it does, but I think they're wrong. I don't think you put people on trial for what they intended or what they believed or what their purpose was. You put them on trial for what they did. And what he did here was lawful. I don't think you can turn a lawful act into an unlawful act magically by looking into the person's mind and saying he had a bad intent or a bad motive. There's a case, actually, in Chicago in the Seventh Circuit that says you can, but I think it's a mistaken case. Of course, I think it's mistaken. I argued it. And there are other cases that go the other way. So, but as a civil libertarian, I would be very upset, even though I didn't vote for Trump, obviously. I'd be very upset if the laws of obstruction of justice were stretched to the point where a president could be charged with it for performing his constitutional and statutory duty of getting changing who the director of the FBI is. It would just create a terrible and a dangerous precedent, and all liberals ought to be opposed to it. But we live in a world of hypocrisy, and the world is divided into, do you hate Trump or do you love Trump? And if you hate Trump, you're willing to stretch the law, distort the law, and if you love Trump, you're willing to distort and stretch the law the other way. And I think we have to get back to looking at things in a principled way and asking what the right approach is, without regard to whether we like or don't like the person who's allegedly being charged.
Now, you in your Washington Examiner piece from earlier today talked about how this case, or actually from yesterday, how this case alleging obstruction of justice relates to the cries of lock her up to Hillary Clinton.
Sure.
You talked about how it relates to Texas Governor Rick Perry, Congressman Tom DeLay, Bob Menendez, and also a case that you've been very involved with is the case against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. How do you think this all relates to each other?
Well, for 20 years, I've been fighting against what I call the criminalization of policy differences, and we're seeing it happening over and over again. You don't like somebody, you didn't vote for him, you want him out of office, find a crime instead of just attacking the person politically. And I was opposed to it, even though I'm a Democrat. When they went after Rick Perry, when they went after Tom DeLay, they went after Bob Menendez, who was a Democrat, and when they went after, when they're going after Netanyahu, you know, these guys were all elected democratically, beat him at the polls, but you don't use the criminal law unless I think it's a clear, open and shut case. It shouldn't be the first, it should be the last resort when you're looking at public figures especially.
Now, what about, forget the firing of Comey for a second, because you feel strongly about that. Mm-hmm. What about the admission yesterday in the Lester Holt interview on NBC where Trump admitted that during a conversation, I think it was on the phone or maybe in person, he asked Comey whether Comey was investigating Trump. A lot of people have pointed to that as inappropriate, as at the very least unethical. Is it appropriate for a sitting president to ask the director of the FBI whether he's investigating him?
Well, it's certainly appropriate for a person who believes he's being investigated, himself or his lawyer, to ask that question. I ask that question all the time. When I have a client who I think may be under investigation, I try my best to find out whether the client is under investigation. Generally, the prosecutor says, I can't tell you. The FBI says, no, I'm not going to tell you anything. But occasionally you do get something. And sometimes you get what's called a target letter or a letter that he's a person of interest or who he's a subject of an investigation. What I suspect happened here is the president, who's not a lawyer, obviously would be curious. Anybody would be. Am I under investigation? And if that happened, I bet that the director of the FBI said, look, if you were under investigation personally, you'd get a target letter. If you haven't gotten a target letter, then you can assume you're not under investigation. That's a kind of rote standard reply. And I don't think there's anything inappropriate about it just because he's the president of the United States. You can argue that if there was a kind of threatening tone about it, if you tell me I'm under investigation, I'm going to fire you. But I didn't see that in the conversation. I think we have to always err on the side of not finding criminal conduct rather than finding criminal conduct. The irony is that that's my position, and that position helps Trump, even though I didn't vote for him. But today, Attorney General Sessions took exactly the opposite position in his news conference. He said, we ought to expand the criminal law, apply it broadly, maximum sentences for everybody. And that seemed to me to be a little inconsistent with the position that Trump supporters are taking, that the criminal law ought to be applied narrowly and as a last resort. I think I'm being consistent, but I don't think the Trump administration is being consistent.
Professor Dershowitz, let's make believe that you are now appointed White House counsel, which I think would be, you know, a great thing if that could happen. But what do you advise the president of today? What's that conversation like today going forward with regards to the future of the FBI, the Attorney General, the Hillary Clinton investigation, the Russia investigation? How are you advising the president if you're in the Oval Office today?
Well, first of all, as a criminal lawyer, I'd be advising him in order to avoid any possible problems. And the first thing I would do is take his Twitter account away and tell him not to talk about any of these things. But, of course, he wouldn't listen. He is who he is. And what I would suggest is the first thing he has to do is appoint the most qualified person in the country to become the director of the FBI, somebody who's just as tough as Comey and has just as much integrity. And that will alleviate the problem, because if he substitutes one person, a good person for another, how can anybody say he was trying to obstruct justice? Now, the list he produced today at the White House, I don't like that list. The top of the list was Judge Luttek, who was an extremist, ideologue, hard right judge who did not have a reputation for fairness. And he had a reputation for being very result-oriented, very active in the Federalist Society, and not somebody who I think the Democrats would support. I think the other candidates are former politicians, some of them, and you don't want a former politician. You want somebody like the person that Ford appointed to replace the disgraced Attorney General of the United States, John Mitchell, and he appointed the president of the University of Chicago, Edward Levy. Or you want a sitting federal judge who has a reputation that is supported by all sides. You want to get the Senate to confirm the new head of the FBI by a vote of 98-2, or better even, 100-1. And there was one candidate put forward, ironically, by a very conservative Republican senator, Senator Lee of Utah. He said, what about Merrick Garland? He would be terrific. He was the guy who Obama nominated to be on the Supreme Court. Everybody said he was qualified, but he didn't get the job because he was appointed by a lame duck president. But, wow, he would get 100-0 confirmation. But I haven't seen his name on the list.
Professor, we've learned a lot about you personally since you've been on the show over the years, your love for baseball, your favorite slice of pizza, your favorite deli. I found a story here in the New York Post a couple of months ago. You brought a 1947 Brooklyn Dodgers National League championship ring into the courtroom as a prop. Is this true?
I'm wearing it right now.
You're wearing it right now.
It's my favorite thing I ever got. It was the year that Jackie Robinson broke in, and it's possible that it was a ring that was owned by Jackie Robinson. We don't know for sure. But that was the year I became interested in baseball. I was a 9-year-old boy in Brooklyn, and I managed to get this ring. It's just beautiful. I wear it all over. And I have a case where the court is trying to take property from my client. And my argument is, look, you just can't take property and give somebody what the property is worth. A ring like the one I have, I was offered 5 times what I paid for it. I don't want to part with it. It's part of, you know, how I identify myself. And so I use the kind of ring as an analogy to my opposition to taking some other property. I love that ring. I was a Brooklyn Dodger fanatic. I then became a Boston Red Sox fanatic. And tonight I'm going to be watching the Celtics. I
Celtics
hope they can
close,
repeat what they did to Chicago.
Close it out tonight.
I know there are some people listening who probably won't agree with me.
So if you could set the record straight, the best baseball player you ever saw was?
Oh, could it be Sandy Koufax? Maybe. I actually saw, I saw Joe DiMaggio. I never saw Babe Ruth. Sandy Koufax was the most remarkable pitcher. He was just unhittable. It became almost boring to watch him just throw it past the batters. Pete Rose, in terms of the most fun player I ever saw, anytime I could get a chance to go to a stadium when Pete Rose was playing, I would go because he just was so much fun. Look, there have been so many great. I actually saw Satchel Paige pitch once when he was about 55 years old. He came up to the Cleveland Indians and he played in Madison Square Garden, and my buddies and I went up to Madison Square Garden for $1.25, sat in the grandstands and watched this guy with his windmill wind up. And he probably was the greatest pitcher who ever lived, but he only played in the major leagues after he was 50 years old.
That's Alan Dershowitz. He's our guy, professor, Harvard Law School, professor emeritus in the newest book, Taking the Stand, My Life in the Law. Thank you for your returning guest appearances.
Anytime.
And we always love to hear about your baseball.
Great. Be well. Thank you.
Thanks, Professor.
Bye.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter. We're also on iTunes. Just search for Legal Face-Off, WGN. Joining us now, a return guest of the show with Rich and Jason. He's the managing director in Chicago of the Berkeley Research Group, Jeffrey Kramer. Welcome back.
Thanks a lot. Good afternoon.
Hey, one of our favorite guests, Jeff. Thanks for joining us. You served as assistant U.S. attorney in the Northern District of Illinois from 2000 to 2009. You were senior litigation counsel. You were responsible for all aspects of many criminal trials, including corruption, securities fraud. So we're going to talk to you today about the federal investigation of Fox News. But There might be some other news that you might have heard of that's breaking as we speak involving the FBI director. So we just had Alan Dershowitz on discussing whether President Trump obstructed justice when he fired Jim Comey. What do you think about that?
It's interesting. I don't think an obstruction of justice charge lies just because of this firing. But I think it can be argued that it could be one data point. In other words, and I think the argument is, and I think I'm familiar with Professor Dershowitz's position, which is obviously reasonable, is the president is entitled to make this decision and therefore couldn't possibly be brought in on obstruction charges. But I think I differ with him in the sense that while a politician is allowed to make decisions that he or she is granted the power to do under law, if their intent is to obstruct or delay, then I think it could be one point brought in an obstruction charge. So getting back to this point, no one's going to bring, or I don't think anyone credibly is saying that this one instance is going to result in an indictment. However, you could envision, and it really is a day-to-day thing where new points come out, where it could be mounting evidence where, while the president may not think he could stymie an investigation into what's going on with Russia and perhaps his own funds, certainly he could send a chill to future investigators. If you get too close, you're going to lose that job. And I could probably make a pretty compelling argument that that's obstruction.
Yeah, it's pretty convenient when you have the power or ability to fire the person who's investigating you, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And even, you know, here in Illinois, and we see a lot of corruption in New York and Connecticut, you're hard-pressed to think of even our politicians, and that's saying something, that had the nerve to fire or to seek to fire investigators that were investigating him. I mean, you didn't see Rod Blagojevich even trying to get rid of the U.S. attorney who was looking at him. And if you go beyond Rod Blagojevich, you've said something.
So isn't that, I mean, not to boil it down to where there's smoke, there's fire, but, I mean, you are a veteran of prosecuting corruption. Isn't it a case of, you know, if it looks like Trump did this to stymie the investigation, there's probably something to that?
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think where I probably fall, and again, we only have this one data point, is I don't think he was necessarily trying to stop the investigation. I just think he was upset it was going on. So kind of like a petulant child, he acted, and he acted in a way that he could. He fired the FBI director. I think, ironically, perhaps, this has done a pretty good job of galvanizing FBI agents. I've talked to many in New York and Chicago and elsewhere. While they might not have agreed with Director Comey's position and what he did with respect to the emails, they certainly believe in his integrity. And to fire him this way, I think this investigation is going to go forward, and it's going to go forward pretty robustly.
It's just like on The Apprentice, right? You're fired. He doesn't like it. Gets rid of him.
Why? That's it. That's exactly what it was.
Why is a special prosecutor not appointed or handling this, or is that possible in this situation?
You know, that's the one thing I'm very curious of with the deputy attorney general here. And if you dial back to earlier this week, either his memo started this firing or it was a convenient excuse for the firing. But regardless, I'm sure he wasn't envisioning that memo being used and he being put out in front as the fall guy. And that's basically what he is. Now, this deputy attorney general, because AG Sessions has recused himself properly from the Russian investigation, the deputy attorney general, the DAG, can appoint a special counsel or a special prosecutor. And I'm still hopeful that that will happen. If he doesn't do it, a panel of judges can do it. Congress would have to act there. But I'm hopeful that something like that will be done soon, because I think the deputy attorney general, who was thrown under the bus, he's an honorable man. He's been a veteran of 25 years or so in the Department of Justice. Can't be happy about how this played out and how he looks.
Jeff, let's move on to Fox News. You were a prosecutor in New York City. We learned last week that the prosecutors at the federal level in Manhattan have opened a criminal investigation along with investigators from the U.S. Postal Inspection Service into the allegations, and there are actually more than allegations at this point because, you know, Fox News has acted on them, of rampant sexual harassment at the Fox News channel. They've paid out millions of dollars already. There are pending lawsuits. There are current employees who are alleging a series of sexual and racial harassment situations. So the feds are now investigating. Where do you think this will go at the federal level?
It's an interesting one, especially because You've got Rupert Murdoch, who is a friend of Trump's, in and out of the White House from what we've seen, and certainly advising the president, is an owner. And here we go back to what we just talked about before. Preet Bharara, who is the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, was also fired. And so some people were thinking, was he fired because of the Fox investigation? But I think where that lies is certainly the shareholders, and this is the argument, so I think you're going to get the SEC involved, if they're, I'm sure they are already, weren't told as these payments were being made what the possible liability was. And that's, I think, the corpus of the genesis, if you will, of where this started and where it could go. It's going to be a shareholder-driven kind of analysis for the criminal prosecutors.
So let's explain that, because you deal with securities law all the time. To prove the allegation, they have to prove that 20th Century Fox intentionally misled investors by omitting or misstating information that an investor would have considered important, right? In other words, the employers of Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly purposely misled investors by not disclosing this information.
Correct. You're spot on. And what companies do when they have what they think is material or relevant information for investors, they won't wait to their annual report. They'll put out what's called an 8K, which is basically a report that goes out so everyone's got equal information at the same time when unique instances happen, and this would qualify as that. They didn't do that. And arguably, they hid the information from investors. And I think most people would, or at least reasonable people, I think, would determine this type of payments. I think they're up to $45 million with payments and costs would be relevant to investors. And it's obviously still going, especially when you throw in a criminal investigation and possible criminal prosecution. So this is lying. This is another one. The Department of Justice through the U.S. Attorney's Office, and there's only an interim U.S. attorney in Manhattan right now, and through the SEC, we see Mr. Clayton was recently approved as the head of the SEC, is going to be looking at this. The problem is obvious. The guy who's head of this is a close friend of the President of the United States.
So last question, even if the payments or the settlement were confidential, which is common, right? The terms of these settlements are usually confidential. That does not make the company, it does not make the company not have to disclose. I'm not stating this very articulately, but the fact that it's confidential doesn't mean that the company didn't have to disclose it to their investors, right? Or so the
Correct.
Allegation goes.
Right, and you're
two separate things.
Your point is exactly right. You can't contractually, get yourself out of the requirement to tell investors what's going on. Otherwise, every company would just do that when they settle a lawsuit or perhaps look in an internal investigation for corruption practices. They would just sign some sort of, confidential agreement and say we don't have to disclose to shareholders. That doesn't get you out of Dodge.
Jeff Cramer, Managing Director at the Berkley Research Group. We always appreciate having you on. Thanks again for your time.
Certainly. Take care, guys.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
Rolling right along here on Legal Face-Off, WGN and WGNradio.com with Rich Lankoff and Jason Whiteside. Joining us now on the phone, Chris Hayek. He's the Director of Litigation at the Immigration Reform Law Institute. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Chris, President Trump's second travel ban is in the news recently. What are your feelings about whether it'll survive a court challenge? Do you think it will fail because it targets Muslims?
I think it will survive in the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court understands the important issues of sovereignty involved here.
So explain that. Why do you think this is an issue of sovereignty? Tell us about that.
Well, the United States, like every other country, has the sovereign right, sovereign power to wage war or engage in foreign policy or admit or exclude aliens basically for any reason or no reason. And this is just a fundamental attribute that the Supreme Court has recognized all nations have. ratified the First Amendment, including the Establishment Clause, it didn't explicitly or in any clear way at all renounce or diminish that sovereignty. And that sovereignty in America resides in the people, because the people are sovereign in America, and they exercise it through their elected representatives. So I think the court recognizes this important aspect of sovereignty and has said so, and therefore it applies the First Amendment very differently, to a very limited extent at most, in this area, including the admission of aliens.
All right, can you tell us too, Chris, how does this travel ban 2.0 differ from the previous travel ban, and why do you think it'll be successful?
Well, the main reason it differs is that it only applies to blocking aliens who are not already in the country or have not already been in the country. The other one involved people who were here already and or had been here before or had visas, and revoked those visas. And those and there are due process rights that people in the country have, even if they're not citizens or lawful permanent residents. And second order doesn't apply to those people.
So the courts, though, disagree with you, right? The courts, federal judges in both Hawaii and Maryland, have talked about 2.0, and they've said that there is significant and unrebutted evidence of religious animus towards Muslims. The judge in Maryland said the history of public statements indicate the purpose was, quote, the realization of the long-envisioned Muslim ban. So isn't the problem with your theory that this is not a ban on Muslims, the prior statements made by the president?
Well, my theory is that, and I believe the way the Supreme Court's going to look at it, is that the courts are not supposed to, under the Supreme Court precedent, they're not supposed to look behind the stated reason for an action in this area. And that's the limited extent to which you can look at First Amendment concerns in this area. You can look at the stated reason, and if it's legitimate, then you don't go any further. And that case was, the district courts were aware of that case, but they distinguished it on very weak grounds, and I don't think that's going to hold up. One consequence of the district court's reasoning is that a private litigant, somebody who was a member of a particular religious group, could, by that reasoning, sue to enjoin Trump's war on ISIS, which is a religion. ISIS is this group where the leader claims to be a caliph or the successor to the Prophet Muhammad and a spiritual leader of Islam. And he claims the allegiance of all Muslims. Now, maybe it's not really Islam. Maybe it's the heresy of Islam. But it's still some kind of religion. And Trump has vowed to eradicate it. That's far worse than any campaign statements he made about Muslims. He told a joint session of Congress, I want to eradicate it from the planet. And Obama had a war going on with it, too. That's when you look at it under the kind of broad definition of religion we have in the First Amendment, certainly that's religious discrimination against ISIS.
So it's
the political system's, it's the people's right to engage in such a war.
So you've got a very, legal theory that you're employing, that the federal government has the sovereign right to protect the country. That I think butts up against, more of the practical question that the Supreme Court ultimately will have to deal with, which is, you can't change the fact that Trump used those words in the past. He did say that, this was in effect a ban on Muslims. So the question to you is, how do you think the current makeup of the Supreme Court, now that we have 9 justices, one of whom is Neil Gorsuch, who was appointed recently by Trump, how do you think that'll affect that dichotomy between sort of the public sentiment of this travel ban versus the sovereignty rights that you've discussed?
Well, I think that they will uphold the precedent that says you don't look behind the official stated reason. That is the reason in the order. This is why I'm doing it, for national security. They will uphold that. I think Kennedy will be an interesting person here, if he's still on the court then, because he may be interested in whether this reason is in good faith or something. But But I don't think that Trump would lose that with Kennedy. I think there's ample evidence that this is a reason given in good faith by not just Trump, but by his cabinet, people who gave him these reasons and chose these countries as being of particular concern. So I think that that may come up a bit in the court, even among the majority, but I think that in the end, the court will uphold its prior precedent and not look behind the stated reason for the order in this case.
Chris, last question before we let you go on Legal Face-Off. How much of an effect do you think a terrorist attack would have on, first of all, the public's perception of the travel ban and ultimately the Supreme Court's decision? You know, we've been relatively lucky in this country to have avoided, you know, any major attacks. On the other hand, we're seeing them almost weekly in places like Paris and other places in Europe. How much do you think that will affect, again, both the public's perception of the ban and what the Supreme Court does? You know, I mean, it's easy. I guess it's easy to, you know, on one hand, it's easy to criticize a travel ban when it's not affecting you. But I think a lot of folks would feel differently about it. And I'm not saying I'm for or against it, but a lot of folks would feel differently if there was an attack on this country.
Well, I would think if the past attacks that have happened are not enough. I mean, I think of the San Bernardino one. According to press reports, this couple just just slaughtered a bunch of coworkers of one of them that had, a few weeks earlier, had given them a baby shower. I mean, if attacks like that and just the possibility of them, based on what's happening in Europe, is not enough to move people, I don't know why a further attack would make much difference. I think people have to think about it. I mean, it's easy to say, you know, a terrorist attack is probably not going to happen to me because they're sort of random and it's unlikely to fall on me, but it's going to fall on somebody if it happens. So I think we should, take that seriously and thinking about this, but I don't think it's going to affect the court, or at least it shouldn't. I mean, it's a legal question, and we all know that there are national security concerns at stake here.
The website is irli.org. He's Chris Hayek, Director of Litigation, Immigration Reform Law Institute. Thanks for your time.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.
Check it out. Ooh, that dress so scandalous, and you know I never can handle it. So you're shaking that thing like who's the ish with the look in your eyes so devilish.
Final guest of the show, Legal Face-Off, WGN, WGNRadio.com with Rich and Jason. Jacob Hubert is a senior attorney at the Liberty Justice Center, and he's on to talk about changing the Illinois Constitution. Welcome to the show, Jacob.
Hi, good to be here.
Hey, Jacob, the book is An Illinois Constitution for the 21st Century. Illinois is a mess. Right. No money, no budget.
Yeah.
Schools are in trouble. Lots of state schools are in a lot of trouble, thinking of closing. The bond ratings are terrible. Tell us why changing the Constitution would help the overall state of Illinois.
Well, there are plenty of problems that state legislators could just fix if they wanted to. But there are other things that really need to be changed at the constitutional level that are more structural problems. For example, you know, our pension problem, the legislators can't fix because the Supreme Court of Illinois has said that you can't change the pension system at all from what we have. And there's no way to get us out of the hole that we're in except to raise taxes. But what you can do is change the Constitution to get that out of there so that we can have more flexibility. So there's that. There's the way that districts are drawn, legislative districts in this state. Of course, we know that the people in charge draw the political maps in ridiculous ways to keep themselves in power. It doesn't have to be that way. we could change the provision of the Constitution on redistricting, have it done by a computer algorithm, and take politics out of that. You could have term limits, too, so these people aren't in there and don't create laws that keep themselves in power. With term limits, you could have everybody out of there in 8 years. So there, this book is about big structural changes like that that we can make to limit state government, to resolve some of these big problems, and also give people better protection for their rights.
All right, so the book has 12 proposals. Let's get into a couple of them in a second. But preliminarily, is one of the problems you see in changing the Constitution the fact that I think the average layperson might not even know there's an Illinois Constitution? I don't say that flippantly, because I think, you know, most people refer to the American Constitution, the U.S. Constitution. But I think, you know, generally out there, I don't know that many people are very familiar with the Illinois Constitution. Is that something that you agree with, or do you think, you know, that's something that people are fairly familiar with?
Oh, I'm sure you're right. I mean, you know, kids today going into college don't necessarily know all that much about the U.S. Constitution, much less the state constitution. But it is important. It does affect a lot of things because it affects how and how much the state government can tax you and what they can pay for and what they can do to you. So people should be more aware of the state constitution because it definitely has a direct impact on their lives.
Jacob, with the difficulty that Springfield has right now, especially with trying to get, you know, anything accomplished, how difficult would this be to actually change the Illinois Constitution?
Well, for sure, right now, the politicians in Springfield probably don't want to do some of these things. I mean, we know that because they, when voters want to put term limits on the ballot or redistricting reform on the ballot, they do everything they can to crush it. They don't put it on the ballot themselves. And then when citizens try to do it, you know, Michael Madigan dispatches his friends to the courts to get it stricken from the ballot. And so we never get these things that lots of people know that we need and want. And so there is going to be a lot of resistance from Springfield. So part of the solution would have to be getting more of the right people elected to make these fundamental reforms so that we can have long-lasting change and not just change that the next legislature could come along and undo.
So you've got 12 proposals. Give us a couple and walk us through why you think these would be effective.
Well, you know, the big problem the state is facing financially is this pension crisis, where there's, you know, over $100 billion in unfunded pension liabilities. And in the Illinois Supreme Court said, you can't really do anything about it. If somebody starts working in the state government and you say the deal is one thing, you have to keep it that way forever. You can't make adjustments based on the cost of living or anything. And it's really unreasonable. Most states have absolutely nothing like this. Nobody in the private sector gets a deal like this. What you could do is you just change that provision of the Illinois Constitution that they've interpreted this way to make clear that that the legislature can make reasonable adjustments if necessary to the pension programs. So that's one obvious thing that I think a lot of people recognize that we need. Of course, it may be difficult to get that kind of change because of the influence the public sector unions like AFSCME have in this state, but that's going to be essential for the state, really for the state to avoid effectively bankruptcy, because spending on these pensions is going to crowd out everything else that people count on. And the only way that you can avoid that is to have a constitutional amendment to give the state more flexibility in dealing with these pensions. Not to leave people totally out in the cold, of course, and take their pensions away, but to make reasonable adjustments so that we can actually afford to pay people some pensions and also do the other things people expect state government to do.
It seems like an attempt to balance the budget. The state, you know, sees no problem with borrowing money. How would your proposals remedy that problem?
Well, we have a chapter about that, and the idea there is that, you know, we have a balanced budget amendment in the Illinois Constitution, but it's pretty toothless because they can balance it by just borrowing money to pay for things. Of course, that's not really a balanced budget in the sense that you and I would think about it with our own finances. You don't think your budget is in good shape if you just keep putting things on a credit card. And that's effectively what our state does and is allowed to do now. So you could put a provision in there, as other states have, to have a real budget, balanced budget, where you can't balance it just through borrowing, and where you can't, and there aren't loopholes when the state says, well, it's, you know, it's an emergency or whatever, so we should be allowed to do it. You could have stricter provisions in there, as other states do. So that's one thing that the state legislature could do and would do if they were serious about getting the state on the right track.
Jacob, about 60 seconds left. We thank you for appearing on Legal Faceoff. If you had a message to Governor Rauner and to Speaker Madigan, what would that be with regards to the proposals that you have in your book?
Well, the message would really have to be to Madigan in particular, because we all know what goes on in that state legislature is in his hands, and they're the ones who can put these constitutional amendments on the ballot. And I think if he wants his legacy to be something other than a state left in a sort of fiscal and economic disaster, you have to look at these reforms and put them out there and get the state on the right track. It can be done. These proposals in this book are not like super abstract. They're not totally a pie in the sky thing. These are practical steps that we could take, many of which other states have taken, to have a sustainable state government, to not have an ongoing disaster like we have now. So I would hope they would look at this and take it seriously and start taking some of these things up, because it's really the only choice we have.
That's Jacob Hubert, senior attorney at the Liberty Justice Center. The website, libertyjusticecenter.org. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Legal Grab Bag time on Legal Faceoff. WGN, Rich, Jason, and Sam. We've got seven stories today. Let's just shake them up. Ex-Chicago Rush owner has pled guilty.
Who even remembers the Chicago Rush?
I didn't even know they were still in existence.
No, they're not, because of this guy, basically. Yeah.
Oh, the savior for Chicago Rush, right? Yeah. David Sterrell.
Sam, did you cover the Rush when they were...
Didn't get so lucky to do.
Where did they play it?
They played to dozens and dozens of people at the Rosemont Horizon, right? Allstate Arena?
Well, he, you know, David Sterrell was supposed to secure it with a bounce check for $50,000. The story is he was supposed to be the savior of the Chicago Rush and Arena Football. He agreed to buy it. There's so much deception that went on, though. Judge Guzman said it was just lie upon lie at the sentencing. They gave
yesterday,
him 3.5
right?
years. Yeah, they gave him 3.5 years for it. Judge Guzman said he'd never seen anyone in his nearly two decades on the bench who pulled off such a variety of scams over a long period. And quote, it's as if the defendant's entire life was just one opportunity for fraud after another. So
the question is,
how do you
convince the Arena League that you've got enough money? Apparently he had no money.
He convinced them that he had $5 million, yeah. And like 2 days before he had filed bankruptcy.
Right.
So I don't know the investigation.
How
into,
low are the standards in the Arena Football League vetting process?
Yeah, the investigation into how many assets he has was not very
it's
thorough.
Like, let's see, you put on a tie this morning. Yeah, yeah. Let's bring you in. Like,
hey, that bar napkin that you wrote down your net worth on looks pretty legit.
Wasn't Mongo an owner, or that was another indoor football league, right?
I know that one of the guys in the Eagles owned a Philadelphia team. That was a while back,
well,
maybe 10
was,
years ago.
Well, that's Bon Jovi's team, right?
Bon Jovi was
that's
the Jaworski. Philadelphia Soul.
Yeah, that's
yes.
Jaworski. That's a, I think, still operating team. But wasn't Mongo McMichael involved in a...
No, he was in that... what was the other one?
XFL.
Was, yeah, XFL.
No,
I thought he was.
Maybe. I mean, who could keep track? But
and who can forget the Chicago Rush League Championship in 2006?
It was one of the great moments in Chicago sports history. Could you name anyone who's ever played Arena Football League?
No.
Well, wait,
I don't think I could.
Didn't
you probably have an old law classmate that was a tight end?
Didn't what's his name from the Rams, right? The Iowa Barnstormer.
Kurt Warner.
There's some alums that went. Made
oh,
it to
you
the
know
NFL.
What there is? Didn't no, well, Doug Flutie played in the Canadian Football League for a while, right?
Yeah. And there was the USFL too, which Donald Trump had a team in.
Correct. It all comes back to Trump Watch.
Trump
Watch on Legal Faceoff.
Second topic in the grab bag, the frat liability at Penn State. A tough story there, and I actually pledged a frat once. Didn't go through with it because of stuff like this. It wasn't this extreme, but there's a death at Penn State.
You didn't
Penn
get
State.
Kicked down a flight of stairs or anything like that?
Yeah, and then they found me behind the ice tray, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, crazy. They're charging him with – they're charging all of the defendants who are members of the fraternity in question here, the Beta Theta Phi House. Charging them with involuntary, or they charged them with involuntary manslaughter. They were arraigned a week ago in Pennsylvania. Bail was set at $100,000. They were released. And the big obvious question here is whether it's appropriate to charge them with a crime. The district attorney said that this was far more than your usual hazing, that the actions showed a complete reckless disregard to the health and safety of this individual. And
it was crazy.
You know, if you read the story,
it's
nuts. I mean, they were covering it up. They tried to make it appear as though this was just an accident. They waited a long time to call the authorities. I think it's absolutely correct that they charge these people with a crime. His blood alcohol content was up to 0.36.
Well, there was one pledge, too, who's been all over the news, and he's talking about how, you know, he kept telling them, you need to call the ambulance, you need to call the ambulance, and, you know, a couple of the frat boys were saying that, you know, no, we're in med school or we're in medical classes, we know he's okay.
Yeah, right.
You know, just leave him at the bottom of the stairs. So it was, and one, they recovered one of the deleted text messages where they told him to just say, well, you know, we'll just tell him he was drunk at a bar, and we found him behind the a dumpster at 10 a.m.
I mean, it's like, you know, the defense lawyer has come out and said that there was not the requisite intent needed, but you know, this is involuntary manslaughter where you don't need the same intent, obviously, as you do for homicide or manslaughter.
When we talk about recovered text messages, how does that process work, and do most cases make texts available? Do you guys deal with this?
I mean, you could easily subpoena them, you know, with the technology being what it is. All that stuff is retrievable. As you know, there's really nothing that gets deleted. You know, we see this often in family law cases.
It's so easy. You send a subpoena to the cell provider, and it goes to their legal department, and you get the documents within 30 to 45 days. So it's easily recoverable. I don't know what the time period is. I mean, I know within a year you're safe, but if it's a couple years back, certain text messages are lost.
Yeah, just a total tragedy, though. I mean, just, you know, really rough for the family, obviously.
That's brutal.
A couple of days back, the former Patriots tight end Aaron Hernandez, his murder conviction was tossed after suicide.
Yeah, there's a legal theory in Massachusetts that says that if a defendant dies before their appeal is heard, then their convictions are vacated. So the judge, Superior Court Judge Susan Garsh, followed the strict letter of the law and said that since he had an automatic appeal that was on file and had not been heard yet, that his conviction should be vacated. So it opens up the prospect or possibility of Aaron Hernandez's estate being awarded some of the contract that's left over from the New England Patriots that they were withholding. So if he's not actually convicted, the theory is if he wasn't actually convicted, then he didn't void the contract.
And in the suicide note, he left the message, "You're rich," essentially.
To his wife.
To his fiance.
To his wife. But it's, you know, all he has is he's got the house that I think they valued at $1.2 million. He's got a Hummer. But by all accounts, he's got nothing. So even if the mother of Odin Lloyd recovers, the amount that she could recover is pretty negligible. But, yeah, the question is whether the fact that his criminal conviction for Odin Lloyd's murder is vacated will affect her ability to recover in the civil case. You know, most lawyers think that she can still recover. This is a really antiquated, you know, theory.
It's very old.
And there's only, I think, 13 states that follow it. But, Aaron Hernandez in some ways gets the last laugh in death. Did you see those they released a lot of his history while in jail? He got into like a million fights. He was threatening people. He, you know, he
was a model, prisoner.
Yeah, I mean,
he was trying to go.
Yeah. Well, goodbye.
He's trying to go.
Welcome. Good luck in the Hell Football League, Aaron Hernandez,
which is just below the XFL.
In the HFL.
You did less than arena football. Yeah. Now.
You got the pitchforks.
You'll be blocking for OJ pretty soon.
Yeah.
Sticking with football, why not? There's a lawsuit, the city of St. Louis against the NFL.
Yeah, well, we know
sour
that
grapes.
Yeah, St. Louis, the St. Louis Rams are gone. They're no longer the St. Louis Rams. So the city of St. Louis has filed a pretty thick 52-page complaint against the NFL and the new Rams for vacating the old stadium. It's interesting because in 1984 there was a lawsuit, which ironically is traced back to the Rams when they were in L.A. But it was the same thing. They were suing the NFL to block the Raiders' attempt to move into the Rams' vacated venue. And the Ninth Circuit told the NFL to create some objective standards in case other teams want to propose a relocation. And so the NFL, St. Louis is alleging that the NFL just ignored those standards when they allowed the Rams to move, and that this had been devised going back to at least 2011 or 2012. So this lawsuit just got underway, and they're seeking to at least recover the $16 million that they lost in trying to woo.
Not the team back. They're not asking for the team to come back, right?
They just want their money so they can recover. They say they spent about $16 million to woo the Rams to keep in St. Louis. But
I went to one of the last home games ever at whatever the Dome was called, TWA Dome or whatever it ended up being, and I mean it was like – You could literally sit anywhere you want. There was no one there. It was a Thursday night game. It was one of the only night games they've had in the last few years, and it was a graveyard in there. It was really quiet. So no surprise they moved to greener pastures in Los Angeles.
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame group, the Eagles, they are suing the actual Hotel California.
More football news. The Eagles we're covering today. The other Eagles. The Eagles filed a lawsuit last week against a Mexican hotel that is called Hotel California. Now, the hotel, which is located in Baja California, opened under the name Hotel California in 1950, more than 25 years before the Eagles released the song. It's changed many times, and the allegation of the lawsuit is that they're trying to capitalize on the Eagles' intellectual property by the association with the song. So even though the hotel denies that, oddly enough, they pipe in Hotel California.
This is the one that we cover where they like have the paraphernalia all inside of like every parts of the song.
What a coincidence that they're playing the song in the lobby. You could also hear mission bells apparently in the hotel. Interestingly, Don Henley has been quoted in saying that the song is really not about California or Mexico or actually about a hotel.
It's about the journey.
And the hotel isn't on a dark desert highway, and you can't check out whenever you want.
you could check out, but you could never leave.
Well, you've got to leave the real hotel. You've got to go.
You gotta leave by 11 a.m. is the checkout time.
I don't know if either of you had tickets to the Fry Festival.
I had, and now I'm part of the class action for.
I had a friend that was texting me the entire time down there. It was brutal.
Really?
It was absolutely brutal. Yeah.
Ja Rule. The question is, how is Ja Rule still?
He had a concert. I use concert in quotations. Uh-huh. He had a $3 show at the Double Door last year. $3 to get in. $3
for Ja Rule.
I didn't go.
He was just at a Paris club, too, with Chance the Rapper. Yeah, he's all over the place.
He gives private shows at tables.
If he would have been doing less of that and more organizing of the Fyre Festival, then maybe he wouldn't be the subject of this lawsuit. But, yeah, there was this musical festival in the Bahamas that cost lots of money to attend, $2,000 for a ticket plus travel. And now, because of the debacle that was that festival, there's a few class action suits being filed against Ja Rule and the other organizers.
They're saying it's like the Boohoo, it's the rich kids festival, and these people were defrauded of their money. But it was actually, I mean, for my friend that was down there, she would text, and they landed in I think it was Nassau, and then they would just group you and people. Like, there's no boarding passes or anything, and put you on these small private planes and fly over. And then when they got there, the cabins they were supposed to have were, like, FEMA tents, and they just told everyone to, like, run and find it, and it was like Lord of the Flies. Everyone fighting each other to get there.
For the four or five supermodels, though, that they had out there, that wasn't the same experience.
I don't think the supermodels even went. They're just like, I can get money to post on Instagram and promote it.
Yeah, well, there were a couple that had, like, villas. There were some supermodels that were there.
There was a couple there, but...
You should have Google the video for Fyre Festival and what they're promoting.
Well, I saw the cheese sandwich that they were serving people. That wasn't quite the level that you were expecting, but...
It's Fyre. I said Fry Festival. Fry. Wow, Fyre. F-Y-R-E. Yeah. What a terrible name.
The one of the firms suing is Mark Garagos, who we just covered on last week's Legal Face-Off. Ja Rule, still collecting residuals from the original Fast and Furious, I think, right? Ja Rule was in there.
I mean, I think he's passing them on to the IRS, isn't he? He did a little stint in
Favorite Ja Rule song? Should we throw that out? Name one.
Put it
Ja
on
Rule.
Me.
If you can name a Ja Rule song,
where's my paycheck? Government cheese.
Put it on me. I said put it on me.
Yeah.
Anybody else? No.
No idea.
No.
I don't even know Craig. Ja Rule.
Moving on. The final topic on the grab bag. The Bulls are out of the playoffs, but the problems continue. A courtside server is suing mascot Benny the Bull. She says Benny injured her shoulder.
Poor Benny.
Using it as a crutch.
She said Benny's been out of control. He was running everywhere that night. Back in 2015, she said she was working with one of the Bulls game when Benny went out of control. She ended up limping off the court. Benny fell on her. She tore a rotator cuff, heard a popping in her shoulder.
He used her as a crutch. Apparently, Benny twisted his ankle, and on the way out, he put his big furry paw on her shoulder, and that injured her, right?
For, well, to Benny's defense, this was after Derrick Rose's buzzer beater against Cleveland.
Exciting.
In game three, the Bulls took a 2-1 series lead. This is back in 2015, so this has been in the works for a while.
Sam, you cover all the Bulls games. Have you ever been involved in an altercation with Benny or any other mascot in the NBA?
No, but I've seen Benny fly into the stands on that little mini motorcycle. Like, he's, you know, it weighs 100 pounds, and he goes off the court, and look out if you're in the front row.
I saw him knock a guy's hat off and topple the guy right out of his chair when he was trying to, and the guy got really ticked off. And I thought he was going to fight Benny right there.
Well, is it not covered? It raises a very interesting legal question. Is that not covered in the contract language on the back of your ticket?
Who even reads it, right?
It's a contract of adhesion, really.
It's size 2. Yeah. Size 2 font.
Yeah. Jason, you're well known to sue anyone and anything. Have you ever sued a mascot before?
I've never sued a sports venue or a mascot.
No?
Yet.
Not too soon, though.
Yeah.
The mascot, the mascot pockets are very deep.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I think if you're working as a mascot, then you probably don't have exactly deep pockets from which to collect.
Could be some immunity.
Who played Benny the Bull just recently retired. He made $200,000 a year.
Not bad.
In appearances,
no way, really?
Yes, I look it up. In appearances, 41 home games. If they go to the playoffs, he gets a bonus. But that guy retired. He did it for like 25 years.
How many costumes are there? I mean, I wonder the...
He's got to just sweat.
I mean, the sweat, there's got to be a little urine in there as well. Yeah. I mean,
kids spitting up on Benny.
Punching you in the nether regions and vomiting. I went to the... I told you I went to the Windy City Bulls game, and their mascot looks exactly like Benny, just a little off.
What do you mean, like a lazy eye?
It's like he's got
a downturned Thor.
He's got a limp. It's like they couldn't afford quite the Benny costume.
It's like Benny from rehab. He's coming in.
Benny after going to the Fire Festival.
Yeah.
That's it. I don't have anything
else. Let's play us out with a little Hotel California.
I think we should. Let's do that. For Rich Lankoff and Jason Whiteside.
We can only do 3 seconds, right, before we get to us.
Thanks to Craig Collins.
Fair use.
Don't incur any money on that.
Jason, say goodbye to our listeners forever.
Anything you may have missed, WGNRadio.com.